The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
David Catania is a member of the Council of the District of Columbia, and he was first elected as an at-large council member in 1997 in a special election, and then re-elected for four terms. He chairs the Committee on Health and serves on the Finance and Revenue, Libraries, Parks and Recreation and Government Operations, and the Environment Committees. He received his bachelor's degree from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and his law degree from Georgetown University Law Center. He's very often in the news as a true public servant. Please join me in welcoming David.
Thank you very much, Corinne. Good afternoon, everyone. I have to apologize right off the bat because I overscheduled today, and you know when you kind of expect too much of yourself, you wind up delivering half as much as you promised. I do have another commitment that's very timely considering the last speaker's discussion of, you know, the challenges that urban hospitals are facing. I'm due to give a $6 million check to one of our safety net hospitals at 2 o'clock, and I have a few items I have to wrap up before that. So I want to thank you for an opportunity to come today and discuss a little bit what we're doing here in the district. I have slightly a different tack, I want to be honest with you. Often these efforts, these collections, we get together and we sometimes celebrate our defeats and the parade of horribles and all the things that we're not doing well. But I think there are a lot of good news stories about what's going on here in the district, specifically with respect to our healthcare safety net, the way in which we are moving the healthcare ball forward. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time this afternoon discussing some of these items. So by a show of hand, how many of you are district residents? Great, terrific. Healthcare has been a focus of mine since I joined the council in 1997. Early in my tenure on the council, I was struck by the incredible disconnect between the amount of money that the district would spend on healthcare and our deliverables. Certainly no surprise to those of you in the room, the enormous age disparities that the enormous life expectancy disparities that exist in the city based on class and income. In 1995, I was given the opportunity to chair the newly organized Committee on Health. And for those of you who are not aware, the council is a unicameral legislature where we are a state and the county and the city, and committee chairmen have quite a lot of influence in deciding the direction of policy within the respective committee. Within weeks of assuming the new committee chairmanship, a steady stream of bad news flowed into my office. Those of you who've been here for a while are aware of some of the things we have not done exactly well with respect to HIV/AIDS. You know, at the time I took over the chairmanship in January of 2005, I had vendors who had not been paid for as long as 6 months, some 9 months. And you can imagine if you're an under-resourced nonprofit and you're essentially funding the government's operations while you're trying to meet your own payroll, your own overhead, and you go 9+ months without being paid, obviously it puts quite a damper on your operations. At the same time, our Board of Medicine ranked dead last in the country, and for those of you who may not be concerned about the Board of Medicine, these are the people who police your doctors. If you're at all concerned about having high-quality care, you want a rigorous Board of Medicine to police the doctors and move the bad ones out. Regardless of what the catastrophe du jour was at the time, there was one thing that was undeniable, and that was no one was in charge of health care here in the district. To hear the government side of the story, you would believe that there wasn't enough money to provide the kind of high access or kind of high quality access care that we were all entitled to. But the truth is, at that time and today, the district has one of the highest per capita expenditures on health care in the nation. And to this day, notwithstanding the progress that we're making, some of the items I'll highlight today, we still have a long way to go. The undeniable truth, though, is that if you are white in the District of Columbia, you have the longest life expectancies in this country. If you are African American, you have the shortest. That's the simple truth, right? And so it isn't as if we don't have the capacity or the services or the wherewithal to produce a long life expectancy. There are very real issues of race and class and income that are dividing these outcomes. To me, it was absolutely bad news to see public officials simply wring their hands and complain without actually doing anything about it. And so I took it upon myself to begin chairing a committee in a new way. I started by reviewing every expenditure starting January 2005, about third, actually that's not true, it's about 28% to 30% of the city's budget is spent on health care. That is an enormous amount of money. I share the largest amount of, largest percentage of the treasury of any of the nine standing committees. The fact of the matter is no one had actually looked at how we were spending money. And what happens, I'll be honest with you, is over time people simply kind of ladle on one expenditure after another. They never actually go back and make sure we're getting what we're spending our money on. And so I have fairly rigorous and I think a very proactive staff. And so we began looking at every single expenditure in the $2 plus billion, right down to the phone bills. Right? I'm going to share with you a couple of things that we found. How many of you are, you know, we hear the refrain of waste, fraud, and abuse over time, right? How many of you believe that it exists? How many of you think it's kind of a tired excuse, right? Well, I gotta be honest with you, it really does exist. And it exists in such a galling, maddening way that it almost shocks the conscience. So I'm gonna give you a couple of examples. You know, $2 billion is a lot of money to go one line item at a time of a staff of five. But we actually took the old approach of trust but verify. And here are a couple of items that we found. We found that the Department of Health leased about 20-plus pieces of property across the city. These were leases that had originated in the late 1980s, most of them, that lacked certain terms and conditions, which you might find interesting, like the number of square feet to be leased, or the price per square foot. It wouldn't surprise you that the person who was very much the people who were able to obtain these leases were politically connected individuals to our then mayor. That to this day we are still extracting ourselves from some of these leases. All right, that we pay as much at the time I started this endeavor in 2005. We were paying as much as 66% of the appraised value in 2005. In rent per year. Okay? Class A, office space downtown, you pay 8 to 9%. So these politically connected individuals in the late 80s, using their friends of, it was a way to simply steal money. I don't know how else to put it. So we leased properties that were poorly equipped to serve the functions we needed, lacked everything from handicap accessibility, etc. And so we bought them several times over. While our leaders at the time, the people who, by the way, our health outcomes didn't come by accident, we've been poorly served by a generation of leaders who allowed their friends to enrich themselves while at the same time crying a river about health outcomes. Anyway, it took some doing to extract these bottom feeders from these leases, and there's no other way to describe them, really. They are stealing money that is not intended for their pockets, but intended to provide health care, high quality, accessible health care for our residents. It took a lot to extract these bottom feeders. But I'm pleased to say we've been fairly successful. It wasn't simply the laziness associated with, you know, leasing. Another area that kind of caught my attention, and again, we were almost, you know, focused in a perverse way on every expenditure. So we looked at a telecommunications audit. And I really encourage every local, county, and federal government to do this because you'll find some eye-opening things. I found that we were, the Department of Health was paying for approximately 4,000 landlines to serve the department, which didn't in and of itself seem shocking, except we only have 1,300 employees. Right? That did not include, mind you, the cell phones. That was simply the landlines. But, you know, being a believer in physics and, you know, trying to, even giving every employee one phone for each year, obviously we still have more phones than we need. So we were able to dramatically beat that back as well. Anyway, what I'm, you know, one other example, Medicaid transportation. There are a whole host of people who make their money off of poor people. And you have to be careful of them, because they're usually the most clever advocates for poor people, all right? They're clever because they know if they can get people like me to extract a bit more money from you and help poor people, that there is an in-between, between the time you put it in and the time it hits the person, and they're there to take it, okay? So be careful. And in this city, we've developed a cottage industry in stealing this money, and one of my favorite areas was in Medicaid transportation. So if you are Medicaid eligible, you were entitled to, obviously, emergency transportation, but also non-emergency transportation. Where the government will pick you up at your house and take you to your appointment and back. All right? As many times as you need it. Well, notwithstanding the fact that we have the most highly developed public transportation infrastructure of any state, right, in the country, our per-person costs rival that of Alaska. You think, well, gosh, what does that mean? Well, in Alaska, they take you by plane to your doctor's appointment. All right? Just bear in mind, by plane. So we were able, and we had any number of individuals who had billed the district, seven figures, and we could only find 3,000 or less in actual services rendered. Because no one ever asked, well, where's the money? No one ever said, where are the bills? Again, how much do we pay them? Well, they tell us. It was the most ridiculous honor system, and would it surprise any of you to understand that if you are, you kind of get these contracts if you know people. So this is important because what you'll hear later, I'll talk about what we've done in dental benefits. We were able to save enough money by organizing a rational Medicaid transportation plan to provide dental benefits for 60,000 people. In other words, let's just be nice and say there was enough waste in transporting people in a non-emergency Medicaid plan. So we're not going to do that. Everyone still gets to go to their doctor. We still pay for it. But we simply took the waste out, and we decided that a comprehensive dental benefit for 60,000 people would be a good idea. In the 4 years since I became chairman of the committee, we've cut the number of uninsured in our city from about 13.5% to roughly 8.5%. We've gone down to about 7%, but we jettisoned back up because the economy has gone south and not everyone has bailed themselves up there. COBRA, et cetera. But still, it places the district, you know, in the top tier nationally with the lowest rates of uninsured. And with respect to children, an area I'm very proud of, and by the way, in terms of real numbers, it means about 35,000 more people in the city are uninsured today, even in this economy, than were 5 years ago. That's about half a war, for those who may follow that, right? We rank with Massachusetts as having the lowest percentage of uninsured children in the country, according to the Commonwealth Fund. And that is a result of, I think, a very sensible policy to increase Medicaid coverage to 300% of poverty, and then to have an alliance program which covers every child, regardless of immigration status, up to 300%. And so that's something I'm very proud of. Back to the dental benefits. So we, 5 years ago, ranked dead last with Virginia and Maryland as essentially having no adult dental benefit. And for some reason, you know, misery loves company, so we were traveling, our friends to the north and our friends to the south, so nobody made anybody look too bad. Well, here's the perversion associated with that. We would pay for an emergency tooth extraction, right? As many as you have teeth in your mouth at the local emergency room, $8,000 to $12,000 per extraction. It adds up, right? And so we thought it was a more appropriate public policy to allow people's misery to elevate to a point where they warranted emergency room services that, of course, added pain and suffering and cost the taxpayer rather than invest in expansive primary care dental benefit, which we now rank first in the nation as having the highest reimbursement. It's so much so that I have routine calls with our managed care organizations that are Medicaid and Alliance managed care organizations complaining that we're too generous and it's busting their budgets. And in fact, I have to laugh. Two of our managed care organizations are actually lost money last year because the dental benefits have been so widely used. And they called and asked if we could make an arrangement for them to get more money. And I explained to them the notion of capitalism and risk-based contracting, where they don't get to keep if they make and get reimbursed if they lose. They're supposed to organize themselves in such a fashion as they win if they do it right and fail if they don't. And so since April 2007, we've had over 30,000 unique visits by adults. We've invested well in excess of $60 million. And, you know, it's a powerful thing to see people who really have been marginalized, right? Your adult Medicaid population. These are poor people, most of whom work for a living, right? And as they age, right, as their teeth deteriorate, which all of ours would if we didn't take care of them, and you start to lose your teeth, it does take its toll on dignity, your ability to access employment. How hard is it to show up in an interview if you have no teeth? And I actually had a woman testify in my appropriations hearing last year with her new teeth. It was an extraordinary moment when I felt that the city had actually delivered what it should on behalf of this resident. Right? And, you know, she explained how it helped her manage her diabetes. So again, it isn't just the opportunistic infections and the viruses and the diminished life expectancy that come with poor oral hygiene. There are also issues associated with it that I think has created the UNC. What did we do with the rest of the money? As we go through and we simply harvest and extract all the waste that we have seen in this government, we reinvested back into healthcare. And so how many of you heard we had actually something in the paper yesterday about earmarks, right? Anyone hear about district earmarks? Come on, are you pumping eager in this room? No one here has heard one word about district earmarks. Yesterday a colleague of mine kind of got wrapped for, you know, some of his practices with respect to earmarks. I'm going to tell you the other side of earmarks and how they actually can work if there's proper oversight, proper public participation. I'll give you a few examples. One is a set of earmarks I've given to Children's National Medical Center. In 2005, we had 37% of our schools with full-time nurses. I thought full-time nurses are important, not just for ice and aspirin, but they're important for a whole host of reasons. Testing body mass index, helping to manage special ed kids. You know, part of the reason we have to send kids out of our system is we can't manage their special needs, health-related issues in the school. So it actually saves us money to have these people present. We're now at 95%. Of our 96% of our schools rather with full-time nurses, and they're coming from as far as Dubai to learn from us how you have an integrated electronic medical record centric system. We have doubled the number of kids in our professionals in our school mental health program, and we're the only jurisdiction last year, again working with Children's, to receive the highest immunization coverage award of distinction by the CDC, the only urban jurisdiction to have made substantial progress in preschool immunization, going from 72% to 93% preschool immunization. Again, these are all investments in our future. But we've done other things as well. Do any of you follow the receiverships that are in the district, whether it be in special ed or individuals with mental retardation or are developmentally disabled or any of them? The reason behind our receiverships has a lot to do with the way in which we organize reimbursements for Medicaid. If your reimbursement rate is really low, how many professionals do you think you're going to attract? Yeah, not many, right? Not all Medicaid programs are created equal, and Medicaid certainly is not the equivalent of Medicare. Am I telling you anything you don't know, right? All right. So it turns out that this time last year, the district's reimbursement rates for Medicaid fee-for-service were one-half that of Medicare. And there had been a long history of underfunding Medicaid reimbursement, which had the effect of forcing physicians out of the service. So when your fee-for-service Medicaid populations, who are your most vulnerable seniors, and developmentally disabled, and mentally ill, et cetera, when they can't get access to care, and they die in these homes, and it becomes the front page of the Post, etc. There's a lot of outrage, there are receiverships, etc. But the solution is as elementary as raising the reimbursement rates to attract the physicians to treat them in the first place. Okay? It doesn't require a Manhattan Project. So in any event, so last year, I doubled almost doubled the tax on cigarettes, and we now reimburse 100% on Medicare and Medicaid, one of the few jurisdictions that does that, in the hopes of attracting more Medicaid fee-for-service providers. One of the things I want to talk about, because it's where I'm headed to next, is United Medical Center. Just the previous speaker mentioned about the trauma, or the trilogy, rather, of urban hospitals. I mean, it's quite right that urban safety net hospitals are dying. They're dying because of the loss of third-party pay insurance, which has been used and which does cross-subsidize Medicaid, Medicare. Even Medicaid at 100% of Medicare. Medicare, Medicaid, they don't come close to reimbursing costs. So what you have to rely upon is a payer mix of third-party insurance that cross-subsidize the government pay. When you have a hospital like United Medical Center, formerly Greater Southeast, 10% of the people are third-party pay and everyone else is government pay, where you lose 22 to 35 cents on every dollar of service, you can't make it up with volume. You just can't. And so, but in any event, United Medical Center, formerly Greater Southeast, this was something that came to my attention in January of 2007, and I want to commend the last speaker for raising this issue, because this is a real crisis across this country. That is the underinvestment in urban acute care. United Medical Center, formerly Greater Southeast, was owned by a company called Doctors Community Healthcare Corporation, and a gentleman by the name of Paul Tuft, who was the CEO. Now, Paul Tuft was a... Are we being recorded?
Yes.
All right, so I want to make sure. I said many times that, he was one of the few people I ever met who could get out of a trash can without taking the lid off. And I mean it. While the city shoveled millions at him, and he put the hospital not through one, but two bankruptcies, he formed this little company called Redmond Tuft and took $6.5 million out for his private airplane. The year before he put the hospital in bankruptcy, he took $3 million out in salary. There were, the company served as an employment center for the Tuft family. Brothers, aunts, uncles, kids, stepchildren. I mean, it was a larcenous cabal that is now bankrupt. Okay? He bought Greater Southeast in 1998, the year before he bought Michael Reese in Chicago. Are any of you here from Chicago? Michael Reese, like Greater Southeast, was a 450-bed hospital that served a safety net for a largely African-American community. I'm going over to Greater Southeast United Medical Center today to see the progress that we are making on our new $11 million pediatric ER, which will be run by Children's National Medical Center, to look at the $30 million in capital investment, including the first ever MRI and a fully restored radiology department, including the cardiocatheterization equipment. Michael Reese has a construction crew on the site of it today in Chicago, but it's a demolition crew. And it shows just the struggles that we have, in urban healthcare, and whether or not there is the will within a community to make the gap up between the under reimbursement of a publicly funded system and the absence of third-party pay. Now, there are a couple other items that I'd like to talk about. I don't know how we're doing on time.
You're fine.
Are we good? Okay. I think that, for those of you who live in other jurisdictions and who tend to go back, I think it's important to advocate for your safety net hospitals because it is in your own interest, right? It is more expensive to not have them than to have them. And what do I mean by that? If you allow your safety net hospitals in your urban core to close, where do you think they seek treatment? At the hospital near you. It puts a pressure on the entire system. And so if we had allowed United Medical Center, or formerly Greater Southeast, to close, we would have 50,000 ER visits that would be coming west, clogging an already tight capacity, putting a further strain on the existing infrastructure. My point is, you simply can't escape the care. They will find a hospital near you. And they will often tax that infrastructure beyond its physical capacity. We have had in the city quite a lot of struggle with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And what I want to provide is perhaps a greater context for this discussion. You have undoubtedly heard the stories about the district having 3% of its population with HIV/AIDS. How many of you heard the references to third world country? Show of hands. Okay, there's a different perspective there that I have. To be sure, the district has not always done its best by any stretch in meeting this epidemic, but there's a context. If you were HIV positive in this region, where would you live? Just answer. Here are your options. Northern Virginia or Virginia, and Virginia's, and I don't mean to offend any Virginians, but you're not my voters, so here it goes. If you are poor or in need of medical care in Virginia, they have a great policy, a great program. It's moved to the district. It's essentially, good luck with that. There is no safety net in Virginia. It's a joke. So if you're HIV positive in Northern Virginia, what do? You move to the district, where every resident between 0 and 200% of poverty is given access to a 100% publicly financed primary, specialty, and acute care insurance model. You move here. Again, what adds to these numbers, right? If you're in Virginia or in Maryland, slightly more evolved, but not much, they go up to, again, for only for adults, 78% of poverty, and not for single or married childless couples, and not for immigrants. So if you are a Maryland person with HIV and you are struggling, where do you move? The district. If you're in need of primary or specialty care, can anyone tell me if any of the suburban hospitals had any acute care capacity for HIV? Or where you would go in the suburban jurisdiction if you are, suburban jurisdictions if you are Spanish speaking? If you go to La Clínica del Pueblo and Mary Center, or if you're LGBT or you're African American, they simply don't have the capacity in the jurisdictions either to finance or the infrastructure to treat you. So we wind up being focal point for a region of 4 million people. People come here, and it makes our numbers look bigger. And also our numbers are bigger because we are vigorous with respect to our ADAP drugs. There's not a waiting list. Anyone, these are our AIDS drugs assistance program, the antiretrovirals to keep you alive. There's no waiting list in the district, and there's no copay, there's no deductible, and there's a very large formulary. So by virtue of us keeping people alive longer, the number of people with HIV grows. Now, we'll be releasing our epidemiology report soon, which shows we have cut our new infections in half, which is good news. Our drug adherence is up by 50%, which is good news. We still have a long way to go. And I want to say that we did contribute. The district government falling apart did contribute to this. When I became chairman, we had no epidemiology department, no data research. Why is that important? Because if you don't know how the epidemic is being transmitted, if you don't know the populations being affected and infected, you don't know how to organize your limited prevention dollars, you don't know how to build primary care and a care capacity for the populations affected. We used one of the earmarks to track with George Washington University School of Public Health. We worked with them to build up our data research department within our HIV AIDS administration, and I think we it's evident that we have the finest urban data in the country now. At the same time, we have invested in this thing called the EpiBerry Initiative, which seeks to provide seed capital, it's a graduate program, for new community organizations, right? Because the epidemic is spreading in communities that look very different than the community affected 10 or 15 years ago. So we're going into these communities, and it's like a boot camp. Everything from how to organize a board, how to apply for grants, how to properly administer grants, how to make sure you file your 990s, et cetera, so that we don't have kind of a disorganized or underperforming infrastructure as we go forward. And finally, I'd like to talk for a second about long-term care. I've not seen a lot of potential are users of long-term care anytime in the future.
You're being kind.
Just a couple of us, right? But I love the subject because I think it speaks to who we are as a community. What kind of long-term care infrastructure do we want? At present, we have 19 nursing homes in the city. A third are excellent, 4 or 5 star CMS rated. we've got a third that are not so good. Okay? And some of them have, the Dutch uncles, right, in the district government. So the effort is in not only improving the quality of care, but it's expanding the options. So what have we done? Assuming you get to a certain place where you are in need of long-term care, the idea is you'd probably rather stay in your own home, right, than go to a nursing home. And so we have made a huge investment in home and community-based care. We have a Medicaid waiver that gives you the same quality of health care in your home as you get in a nursing home. It's called our EPD waiver. It costs us $27,000 a year versus $67,000, right? Higher quality service, customers happier, saves us money. At the same time, I realize that people are going to have to eventually find their way, and many may eventually have to find their way into nursing homes. So we just passed, the first Tuesday of this month, a measure that I authored last year after about a year of study on the subject. And we looked at how would we organize our skilled nursing facilities in a way to provide the highest quality care. And so the district is the first jurisdiction in the country, because of this, which passed, that has a requirement for a physician presence in nursing homes. Well, CMS requirements have always required physicians, correct? No. They required a relationship, but not a presence. And that was really directed out of rural nursing homes where there were not perhaps a lot of doctors. You couldn't have a doctor on staff. But we have a lot of doctors in cities. And so we now have the first ever requirement of 0.2 hours per patient per week. We've done a lot with respect to discharge planning, because so often nursing homes, if you check in, kind of the idea is they don't really have an incentive to send you home, because that's revenue. So we build in at the front end and biannually a whole discharge planning regimen and a forced connection with our long-term care infrastructure to help people kind of make the decisions that are best for them. That and a whole host of other things involving our licensure of nursing home administrators and the geriatric specialty training for the people who actually work in nursing homes, and a whole host of other things that AARP is very pleased to now be signing on as a national model. So anyway, those are a few things that we are doing here in the district. It's a great time to be in healthcare in the district. I think we've made some progress. We have a lot further to go. We are a rich jurisdiction, and we have a lot of talent here. I see some of you in this room. Maybe you'll grow up and after you graduate, want to come work for the district government. It's different than what it was a few years ago. We ferreted some of the crazy stuff out, but every once in a while, you still have a little bit left. And with that, I don't know if we have time for any questions.
Sure.
If you can stay for a couple of more minutes. Questions? Come on, don't be shy. Well, I do have a quick question. As somebody that used to use Greater Grand Teton Hospital, hearing about Peter Tuff,
is it?
What was done to sort of, is there any litigation in progress for someone who is sort of, bankrupt? Using that hospital is quite difficult, especially for the money. So I can imagine, what has been done to actually address this issue of someone taking a hospital that provides them a service?
Right. Here's the thing. You can hide behind corporate shields in this country to get away with this. And that's what he did. There were no criminal consequences for his actions, and frankly, very little financial consequences for his actions. And he had a model that worked for him, right? Not for us, but for him. And the way it would work is, he would take the reimbursements, right, from insurance, third party, and government. He would take that money and pocket it. He made his money off the backs of the doctors and off the providers, whether it be Pepco or whether it be the pharmaceutical companies, whoever would provide the goods and services, he simply wouldn't pay them. So he would take the money from the reimbursements, right, and then he would let the accounts payable stack up, And then at some point, you know, if you owe the bank, you know, the adage, you owe the bank $50, you have a problem, you owe the bank $50 million, the bank has a problem. Mm-hmm. He would get to the point where he would simply put his vendors at all of his hospitals across the country. The system is now bankrupt, right? Michael Reese is being knocked down, as I mentioned. He simply ran it as, you know, I certainly think that there were actions that federal prosecuting authority could have looked at. I do. But what the only thing we could do was to use our efforts to extract him, and we did. Okay. I can go into detail about all the actions the committee took and I took along with Chairman Gray, and the pressure that was made to bear on him so that he would sell it. And so when the city used its tobacco money to buy the hospital, it was $79 million. It was divided, $29 million of it, $30 million was for new equipment, $20 million was for a two-year operating for the new operating capital for the new owner, and then $29 million was to buy the facility. And I was very adamant that he walk away without a penny. So even though we paid $29 million for it, the deal was as follows. I wanted us to pay the people that he had cheated. Okay, from the first and second bankruptcy and those who had not been paid. So first we paid for the goods and services that were offered to keep the hospital open. We had demanded that he come up with some short-term financing while this was, you know, while we were winding this down. I let that get paid, because again, I believe you should pay your bills. In the end, he didn't get a cent. Now, he'd already gotten paid many times over, to be honest, right? And I don't think he or his family are ever going to miss a meal. But it really wasn't in my capacity as chairman of the legislative committee to prosecute it. I absolutely think he should have been, right? I do. I think what he did was criminal. I think he engaged, if you know you're never going to pay the bill and you invite the person to perform, I mean, I think we know what that term is. But going forward, I'm very excited about this facility. I'm excited because we have added, even with this layoff of 40 people, we are net up 120 people at the hospital. We've added two floors of skilled nursing facilities, so nursing home beds. We've added an entire floor of long-term acute care, which is kind of like an ICU, specialized ICU unit. We've doubled our residential mental health capacity. We've added equipment that they've never had, as I mentioned, MRI. I'm a patient, by the way. I have a shoulder injury, and if I'm going to ask other people to have confidence in the institution, I get treated there, too, and get great care. And I'm very excited about everything from our new hyperbaric wound chambers for diabetes, et cetera, to our Children's National Medical Center partnership for our pediatric ER, because so many of our kids in the city live in Ward 7 and 8. And should have access to the highest quality emergency pediatric services. Also takes the pressure off my main campus on Michigan. Yeah, let's we'll follow up and then we'll do this.
And this is actually a slight different question about you. I know that in the news you had some sort of a fight with pharmaceutical companies and actual payment for doctors. Has there been any fight? I know this is a SafeRx Act, I think it was.
Well, Sean can tell you about our battles with pharmaceuticals. 2 years ago, I got named the pharma's number one enemy, second to the Attorney General of New Jersey. I like to think there's a lot of distance between us. I don't know, not so much, a little bit. No, I've had a love affair with the pharmaceutical industry that has to do with a whole host of issues, which Sean can talk about more, you know, more eloquently than I can, but it has everything to do with access, safety. And so we've done a number of things that have not exactly made them happy. Everything from preferred drug lists and supplemental rebates, pharmacy benefit management legislation. The most recent, we put the kibosh on therapeutic interchanges without patient consent, which is a growing issue, which you can imagine, right? Chemically dissimilar drugs. Doctors, the pharmaceutical companies conspiring with the pharmacies to switch and not telling you or your doctor, that's now legal in the district. And the thing I'm very proud of, which is the licensure of pharmaceutical reps. You know, we're the only jurisdiction in the country that has a code of ethics and an ability to extract them and deny them a license and a livelihood if they engage in off-label prescribing or if they offer false or misleading information. And I think, that there's an association of pharmaceutical reps who are now trying to adopt their own code of ethics, and they actually call out our legislation as a reaction to, because they see this thing happening in the future.
We'll just take one more question, Stephanie.
I worked at the long-term care ombudsman program with the AARP Legal Counsel Committee, and we ran into the wonderful work that was done.
Jennifer Berry.
Yes, with Jerry Kucinich
and Vera Mann.
And one of the things that we were researching was corporate structures of nursing homes. Is there anything that can be done as far as regulation goes in the same way that drug companies have been regulated in this way that could make sure that we don't have another tuft in the district running the same game?
We have a couple of homes that I'm not thrilled with their current management. And so what we've done in this final measure, we have a way to seize the license of a nursing home, but we haven't had a way up until now to hold the operator's license. So we have a nursing home administrator. You have to have a nursing home administrator license to run a nursing home. We've never really tied that person's livelihood to the performance of her or his nursing home. And so they're usually the management. So now we can do that. And we've also expanded the way in which we can actually seize control of the nursing home away from either the management or the operator, or the owner, rather. And so we've stepped that up. But what it comes down to is providing our Department of Health and our Health Regulations and License Administration senior deputy, Dr. Waldron, who's great, with greater tools like this to actually start putting pressure for high performance, okay? Along with the capacity to find and define, have the fines be substantial. Let me just say that you can really tell the quality of the nursing home by the number of EMS calls to the nursing home. Okay? It just basically sums it up. And so you have some nursing homes that have multiple EMS calls a day, right? And that's telling you something. That the person is not seen routinely at the physician, but there's no one on the premises tending to their chronic disease, et cetera. And so, we have estimated that we're spending about $21 million a year in preventable hospitalization that originates out of this poor healthcare infrastructure in our town. That's an estimate. So it's not all about money. I mean, I spend a lot of time focused about money because I've got to cut about $400 million out of our budget next year. A lot's coming out of mine. And if we're not careful, if we're not always mindful about how this money is being spent and how we make the most use of it, then, there can be real consequences. So a smarter system that has the physicians at the nursing home, treating them where they live. We've also expanded the types of services that we now require among nursing homes, including dialysis, because again, we are transporting people to dialysis back and forth. You get transport trauma, the added expense, et cetera. If you have a certain size nursing home, you ought to be able to provide those services on the site. Same is true for mental health, for substance abuse, for rehabilitative services, et cetera. So we've given the Department of Health the flexibility to say, to look at economies of scales by size of home. But increasingly, we're going to put pressure on the nursing home to provide the services that they have the critical mass to provide and not simply farm it out, because nursing homes have no incentive to provide any of the services on the site. Because by calling the ambulance, they essentially force those costs off onto the emergency room and off onto others. And we're just trying to reconfigure this, but how do we keep a call tucked out? That's hard. I think as long as we get a high quality product at a good price, I'm less concerned about who, to be honest. That's our market. But if we're going to get someone like Tuck who is using us, then we, they're usually poor performers, and we'll use the regulatory infrastructure to extract them. And I've got one home in particular that I've got my eye on. It's called Grand Park. I believe in letting them know that we're coming, right? It's the largest and only nursing home in Ward 7, and they are poor performers. And if I have my way, the current owners will not be in business there much longer. That's my effort. And there's another one, Carolyn Boone Lewis. and Rock Creek. Right, those are free. Stay tuned.
Please join me in thanking.